Good morning.
Hi, Tootie.
How are you?
Very
Do
good.
I call
good morning.
You William or Bill?
Bill is fine. Thank you.
And it's Leibowitz.
Yes.
We are on the air now, and so I'm going to get myself a microphone, too, because you have the book I have in front of me. When I opened this up from the package that it was sent to me in, I thought, oh, my goodness. What is this? And it says Miracle Man right on the front. But it's the eyes and then all of these equations around. And that even goes at the beginning of each chapter. And so would you tell us about you first and then how you come to write this book?
Sure, sure. And thanks so much for having me on the show. I really do appreciate it, Tootie.
Well, I appreciate it.
How I came to write the book, firstly, my background, I'm actually a long practicing media lawyer, but I got the interest in writing the book basically because I wanted to write about a real hero for a modern time, someone who could really be inspirational, because one thing that's bothered me over the last number of years is that so many of the celebrities in America really have no basis in merit. They are just famous for being famous, almost. And I think that sort of undermines what the whole idea of being famous used to be. It was about people who had special abilities and earned public celebrity. So with Miracle Man, I created a character who actually is an anti-celebrity. He has no interest whatsoever in having people know what he looks like or being on the cover of magazines. He absolutely rejects all of that. But what he does have are these extraordinary abilities and intelligence that's never existed in the history of mankind, and he selflessly devotes that to curing diseases, doing great things for people. So I thought he's a real hero, an anti-celebrity, and I just thought that would be very refreshing in the times we live in and really inspirational. So that was the idea, you know, create a hero who doesn't, you know, fly through the sky or whatever. He actually is believable because his ability is this extraordinary intelligence. And unlike so many who in today's society are just interested in making a lot of money or whatever, he doesn't. He invents these cures on a nonprofit basis, and I, as I said, I thought that would be refreshing to people and be something that people could maybe find a little inspirational.
Well, I think what a marvelous thing for you to do, because I think in this day and age, even though it seems like celebrities get more and more attention, but it's not always for the right reasons either. And
right.
So for you to take this idea and write Miracle Man, it is an inspiration, and people will, just the very fact that they look at the cover of this book, they want to know what's inside. And
yeah,
so you have taken someone and given them the purpose that can fulfill what that person wants themselves, but also to be helpful to others. It's not about him, it's about what he does, what he tries to do. And so is this someone that you know, or are you saying celebrity isn't all it's cracked up to be, and then when we find out these people aren't what we thought they were, it gives all of them kind of, well, there's a shadow cast over all of them because celebrity is not what it once was or what we thought it was.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And the other interesting thing here is that you know, a lot of the action and the drama in the book, of course, comes from the conflict, because you would offhand think that if this super genius, which is what he is, he's like 10 times an Einstein in terms of his intelligence, an intelligence never before evidence. You know, you would think if someone like this is devoting himself to curing diseases, he's going to be the most popular guy in the world, and everybody's just going to love him. And, of course, the irony is in the book that he has a lot of foes, opponents who are not at all happy at what he's doing, and that creates a lot of the drama and the action that kind of unexpectedly you realize that he is in many ways a marked man despite doing this wonderful work.
But, you know, it takes strength to not succumb to the type of celebrity that is out there. If this man with all of this intelligence and what he could do with it, other than finding cures for all kinds of diseases or helping mankind not only be healed but also be better at what they do, he doesn't want the limelight. And, you know, I thought it was probably deep down inside of all of us that most of us think, oh, well, a little bit of it would be fun.
Well, one of the reasons that he doesn't want any limelight is has to do with his background. As you know, he had an extremely tragic start in life, and a lot of difficulty and sadness. Ultimately, he lands up having a mentor, and that mentor impresses upon him that you know, don't get into the celebrity game. Don't think you're some kind of rock star of the intelligentsia. You know, people want you for speaking engagements and parties and all kinds of stuff. Don't squander this incredible gift you have, because you don't know how long you have. I mean, there's some feeling in the book, and Bobby Austin, you know, the protagonist himself, believes that he doesn't know where this intelligence came from. He doesn't know how long he'll have it. So for as long as he has it, he really has to make the most of it and be quite fanatical in terms of putting out the work product. So some of his views about anti-celebrity definitely come from the way he was brought up, but it's really powered by the fact that he just thinks, you know what, I only have so many hours in a day, and who knows what my life expectancy is or whatever. I have this unique gift. I just can't waste time. And that really powers him, because, you know, he just realizes that every minute that he has is a minute that is unique, because there's no one else who has these extraordinary intellectual powers. But I agree with you. I mean, if I were him, I think I'd want a little bit of celebrity, just a touch. But he, you know, he's a very complex character psychologically. He has a lot of demons, a lot of internal conflict, and that powers, you know, everything he does. There's, you know, as you know, quite a bit of sort of psychological tension in the book.
And, you know, I was wondering, too, as I'm reading through the book, is this Miracle Man, is that telling us something about you as well?
Well, I can tell you one thing, Tootie. I don't have his intelligence, so there's no comparison there. No, when I think of what I was trying to achieve in writing the book, aside from creating this anti-hero that I think can be so inspirational to many people, there were a lot of underlying spiritual messages that were important to me to convey, and one of them is the fact that the sanctity of human life and the importance of even one life, because, as you know from reading the book, he started off in an extremely bad way and highly imperiled, and it was a miracle that he survived. And ultimately, of course, his surviving changed the world, because of the incredible medical cures that he created. And it would have been so easy for that life not to be there. And so, you know, when you watch the news and all, and you see all the terrible things that happen throughout the world, the hunger, the wars, and all these people dying, I think, what I always think is, I think, wait, you know, this is just statistics, but for all we know, that kid who just got killed in Nigeria or in the Ukraine or whatever had an extraordinary ability that could change everybody's existence. You know, there is such a irreplaceable fact about every human being, and that was an important message I wanted to convey, because it's so easy to just look at human life as statistics and, you know, watching the news, that's all we see. But you never know when the life that is lost might have been a life that could completely revolutionize human existence. And that's, of course, what happened with Bobby Austin and Miracle Man. So that was another thing that I sort of just wanted to try within an entertainment context. You know, I wanted to just, like, plant that little seed and have people think, wow, what if this kid had died, as he should have, because we know how the book begins. What would have been lost? So anyway, that was something that was important to me.
Well, and I think when you give us that to think about, many times, and I mean, war is such a terrible waste of human life, but it just seems like it will continue to go on until there can't be any war like that. But there's war in various ways, because I look at all of those lives that have been lost through the ages, and then what a difference even one of those being the Miracle Man or that person could have made such a difference in our continuing being on this planet and have it be for real good.
But yes, that absolutely.
When you're thinking about this, did you ever have any time that you were kind of stuck? I mean, a lot of writers have that. I didn't ask you or let our listeners know. Is this your first book or is this one of your books?
This actually is my first book, you know, it took me a fair amount of time to write it. It took me a few years to write it, and I actually did a lot of research before I wrote it in two main areas. One was the nature of human intelligence and genius in particular. I read a great deal about that, including biographies of certain geniuses that have lived in the last 100 years, because I, in describing in Miracle Man, you know, all of the amazing things he did at a young age that made people realize how unusual he was, I wanted it to be based in reality. I didn't want to just make up stuff. So what I essentially did was I saw what really had happened with real people, and then I magnified it, because obviously Bobby Austin is supposed to be in a completely different league. So I did a lot of research on that, and then in terms of finding the cures for the diseases, I didn't want to ask the reader to just make a leap of faith. And, you know, I didn't want to just say, and then he cured this disease, and then he cured that disease, because I thought, you know, that's asking too much of the reader. So I did a lot of research into various diseases that are mentioned in the book, what cure attempts were made, what the nature of the diseases are, the medications that have been used, and certain general medical and scientific principles. I had quite an extensive background in biology from my college years, but I really did a lot there, because I wanted to cobble together cures that looked believable to the reader so that I wouldn't lose the reader, you know, in that aspect. So while I tried not to get into too much scientific detail because I didn't want to bore people, it's not a, you know, a science class, I wanted enough so that as they read the story, they said, wow, that's incredible. So that's how he did it. That makes sense. So that took time, in addition to writing, doing that underlying research to give plausibility to Miracle Man, that took extra time that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have in many novels.
Sure. And the thing is, too, a novel, do you have to have so many words for it to be called a novel, or why is this one a novel?
Actually, I don't think there's any magic number. This is a pretty standard length book for a novel. You know, it's, I believe, you know, 390 pages or something, depending the format, if it's ebook or print. When novels get really short, meaning like 60 pages, 70 pages, sometimes then they're called novellas, to indicate that they're, you know, really, really brief. But once you get over, I think, 120 pages, well, that would still be considered short, but once you get over 150 pages, I think you're firmly in novel land, and as you know, some aren't much longer than 150, and then you get books like Harry Potter, the series, where they can have 650, 700 pages.
Yes, but, you know, and speaking of Harry Potter books, that seemed to turn a nation of young people that was not reading very much into wanting to read and just capture every word that was in the book and wait for the others to come out because they had enjoyed it so much, or they thought this was so interesting to them that they became readers again.
You're right, and I saw that firsthand with my daughter. She was growing up with the Harry Potter novels, and I was just amazed that here was a kid, when the first one came out, I guess maybe she was 8 or 9 years old, that she would want to read a 600-page book. I couldn't believe it, and became obsessed with them, read every page, read chapters again, read the book twice, and was online to buy the next. And I think you're so right. That was one of the wonderful things about Harry Potter, that that it so captured the imagination of kids all over the world that they put down their video games and the television and everything, and they sat and read lengthy fiction that they weren't reading because they were told they had to in school. They really wanted to do it. I think that the author made such an incredible contribution by captivating kids like that.
Yes, and you know, I found that teachers that were teaching those young people, they were captivated by it also because of watching and hearing the students talk about that once they came to class. And so I had mothers and fathers tell me, I didn't think my son or my daughter would ever really read again like we did. We were growing up. But Harry Potter turned it around.
Absolutely. No, it's wonderful.
Yes. And then, too, we think technology is so good in a lot of ways, but it also had made junkies out of us. I still carry a large bag, which I call a purse, but I could have a book or two in there, so if I'm stuck and inconvenienced by either trains or some other something happening in my way getting to where I'm going, I can take that out and really enjoy that little break rather than being frustrated by it.
Sure. Absolutely. And you know, I personally prefer paper books, but I know so many people love e-books and you know, the Nook and the Kindle and all, because they can have you know, 100 books, 200 books in this little thing that, as you say, they can slip into a purse or a briefcase, and it's great. Anything that encourages people to read and makes it easier for them, I think, is wonderful, because, you know, so much is just videos and TV, and so it's great to actually see people reading.
Well, and then you can tell when they're speaking, their vocabulary has it goes exponentially when you read a lot of these books and hunger for more. And so that would help us with communication. Instead of saying, well, I thought I was saying the right thing, they would know what they really meant to say.
Yeah, so, you're right. You're right, Tootie. And you know what else I think? I think that reading novels increases people's imagination, because you have to immerse yourself and visualize, and obviously if the book is well written, it helps you visualize, but still you're using your mind, your imagination. It's not all laid out for you like when you go to a movie or watch TV and you just sit there, you know, having it sort of bombard you. You get to use your imagination, and I think that is one of the reasons why people do like to read, because they're creating with the author their own private world that is particular to them and their imagination and their life experiences.
It's on the book cover, you will see William R. Leibowitz, but I was given permission to call him Bill, so I will. That's for our listeners out there. But did you envision yourself as being a person that not only would become a lawyer, but an author as well, when you were in elementary, high school, college, all of that?
Well, I don't know if I really did envision myself that way. I always loved reading really good novels, and I was very impressed with the way certain authors could draw images out of words and make it so real and so powerful. The power of the use of words, and that doesn't mean using big words. It just means, you know, conveying emotion and scenes with words. And so in reading a lot of the really good authors over the years, I always thought that was something very special. And it's funny, when I read Miracle Man, a lot of it, of course, you know, it keeps the story moving and it's telling all the action and the drama and everything. But then there's certain passages that when I reread, I really like them because they are, in my view, particularly visual, and, you know, they paint a picture that you can see. And the whole book isn't like that, because it's not that kind of a book, but I do like that. You know, I think that's the amazing thing about language.
Yes. You know, I have an author friend. She has mostly written children's books, but she was working on a novel. She said she always wanted to do that and had the idea for it. But she said, I want the reader that eventually reads this book to not only in their mind's eye see what I'm sharing with them there, but also can almost smell what the aromas are in the air. And I just think, I want to read that book. She said,
yeah.
It sounds like something that just envelops you to where, and I am one that will reread because I want to get everything out of it that was possible. But to describe it that way, it makes me want to read the book, and it's not even finished yet.
Yeah,
but that's
well,
in this book too.
Yeah, I'll tell you, there was a book written, I forget who the author, I believe it was a French author, and then it was translated. I think it was called Perfume, and the remarkable thing about that book, it was sort of a mystery, a whodunit kind of book, but the incredible thing about it was that the underlying whole plot had to do with sense. Because I believe the protagonist or somebody owned a perfume shop or whatever. And that particular author, I believe it was a French author, and I think the book was written quite a long time ago, his ability to describe scents was mind-boggling. And I remember when I read it, and I read it quite a while ago, maybe even back when I was in school, I just couldn't believe it, because I think the hardest thing to really describe is a scent. And this individual was describing so many different odors in this book to the point where you could visualize and smell the odor. I said, this individual is a master writer. It was amazing. Unfortunately, I don't remember his name, but I think that was the title.
Enjoyed having a conversation with that author?
I think he actually had a unique ability in that area, because if you think about it, with all the books you might read, you don't really come across descriptions that much of scents, right?
Yes.
I mean, you may hear a cursory thing like there was a sweet smell in the air or something like that, or the air smelled from a particular flower. But this went to a whole different league, and I think the author had a unique ability and a unique interest in doing that.
Well, and that you, after all this time, would remember that when I'm talking about the way she wanted to have the readers enjoy her book. And she also said that there, in different places where the main character would go, she wanted to be sure that she had him there in the right time of year to have maybe even lilacs or whatever in bloom,
sure.
So that fragrance would be there. But, see, sometimes we take it for granted that if you can tell a good story, you can write a good story, and none of this other embellishment even matters, but it does.
I think it really does, and I think that, in modern writing, particularly, commercial writing as opposed to what's considered like fine literature, I think sometimes some authors are a little too cursory in the way they write, in the sense that they just tell the story, action, 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 very little description of characters or setting. And I think something is lost with that, because I think to the reader who wants to become enveloped in this world that the author is creating, part of what makes it so interesting for the reader is the development of scene and character, so that you really can visualize it and it seems very, very real to you. I tried in Miracle Man to do enough of that to hopefully draw the reader in to visualizing the characters and the scenes and all of that. And that was important to me.
You know, I think that you capture this in this book. And one of the places that, as you were speaking, led me to this, you probably know word by word anyway, but for those that haven't read the book yet, it's on page 362, and he's talking to Alan, and he said, if you hadn't walked down that street on that day at that particular time, or if you hadn't noticed that bag, or if you had been afraid or didn't want to get involved and had turned away, I would have been dead for sure. If I had died, none of the work I've done would have happened. You know, that I went back and reread it several times because I just wanted to get the full effect of that, because we were speaking about those things early on in our conversation, Bill, but right here in your book when the words just pop off the page to you, because how many times, if you interviewed, maybe 10 or 50 people, how many times they say, if, and that big word, if, fits so many situations. But here it is in this book, and so it pulled me in even closer, because if he had died, none of the work that he's done would have happened. And it might be a long, long time before anyone even thought about what they could do with what he had already done. But you write that way, and you make the reader feel that they're right there and watching everything and hearing things, too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, that sort of conjures up like a spiritual aspect that I think an undercurrent in the book, and I know a bunch of reviewers pointed that out, because there's so many things in Miracle Man that you wonder why did that happen? Like, what are the origins of Bobby's extraordinary intelligence? Where did it come from? Why him? And why does he have it? And what are the odds that a kid like that with such a tragic beginning would be the one to have that? And why was he saved in the way he was? And, you know, all of those things. And I think everyone in life, they experience so many things that why, how come, what if? And, you know, underlying the storyline here, there's a lot of that. And I think, as one of the characters says to Bobby at one point, when he says, well, how come, how did this happen? It's all so crazy and weird. And one of the characters says to him, if you want those answers, you have to look to your faith. That's the only way you'll have those answers. And, you know, that just sort of resonated with me. And that spirituality, underscoring some of the plot and the action, is there a grander design here? And as you know, in the book, Bobby has a feeling about of good, evil, good against evil conflict on a universal scale, a metaphysical scale. And we don't know if that is really happening or if it's just in his mind, but once again, that underscores that whole thing, which harkens back, as you said, to that discussion that he has with Alan on the beach toward the end of the book.
Yes. You know, as you have developed Miracle Man and written it so well, is this a character that possibly you'll want to use again, or is it impossible to do that?
Well, actually, as you know, the ending, I think, was a surprise to a lot of readers. I thankfully got very good feedback on it from readers, that they were surprised by the ending and they liked the ending. And the ending is such that it does leave open the possibility for what happens next, for a sequel. And I have begun sketching out a sequel, because I think there are a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of great action and storyline that can be developed in a sequel. And so I am planning that. And frankly, you know, you kind of get attached to some of the characters. You know what I mean? They begin, to an author, to sort of have a life of their own. And I think a fair number of them in a sequel could be used and move the story along to another level. So I am planning on doing that. But an interesting thing about that, from a writing point of view, is that because you've already developed the characters and the reader knows who the characters are, understands them, that allows you in a sequel to concentrate on other things, you know, plot, action, etc., because certain characters don't have to be established in the reader's mind. So I think that has a lot of interesting possibilities.
And speaking to that, though, and I love having the book in my hand, and I'm so grateful to have had it before our interview today, but do you see this being something that Hollywood being what it is and New York City being what it is, that it would be performed either movie, television, or on stage?
Well, I've actually had a lot of readers say, wow, this would make a great movie. It's got to be a movie. You know, I hope there's someone in Hollywood paying attention to that, because I do think it would be a really, really good movie, because a lot of the, aside from the fact there's a lot of, you know, I think interesting drama and action and all that that a movie needs, I think a lot of the characters are very cinematic, and I even get people writing to me saying, "Who I know who should play Bobby. I know who should play Christina." You know, it's really funny. I've even had some British readers, and of course they recommend British actors. But I think it would make a really, really cool movie. I'm hoping that I get some attention along those lines. It's not easy, as you can imagine, but I do think it could be a good movie. Theater, actually, it's interesting you brought that up. I never thought about that. I guess that's possible. But, you know, the theater business is so difficult and takes such investment, and there's such huge risk in it that that's pretty tough, you know, to get into that. But who knows? I mean, it would be nice. I mean, for an author, I think to see certain characters on the big screen and see them portrayed by really good actors who, you know, just breathe extra life into the character, I think that must be incredibly fascinating for an author.
All right. Now, you practice law in New York City, so you did
yes.
say media lawyer. So you would be very equipped to decide what you would want from that or what you could allow, because movies, they want you to sign away anything on this, but since you are, this is such an extraordinary book, maybe they would want you to help them write so that they could put it on the screen and do the best effort at it. So,
well, you're absolutely right, Judy. What I would hope to do would be to help write the screenplay, not be the sole writer, because writing screenplays is a tremendous art in of itself, but to be like a co-writer or an assistant writer of that, and I would, because I would want to be sure that they really do leave the essence of the book intact and don't turn it into something completely different. Because, as I said, aside from me wanting Miracle Man to be a really good entertaining read for people, because it is about entertainment, there are certain things in it and in the characters that I think, you know, are important, and I wouldn't want to see all of that just diluted out. And also, of course, you know, I think it would be wonderful to have a little bit of a say in who the actors would be, because, you know, great actors just make such a difference. And so I'd hate to see, like, Bobby Austin be some guy who was unbelievable because, you know, Hollywood picked him because he's great looking, but nobody could ever believe that character is the smartest human being that ever lived, you know, because sometimes, you know, they just decide, oh, that he's a marquee name, he'll do. So yeah, I would certainly try to achieve that. I just hope that you know, I ultimately have that opportunity. That would be, you know, amazing.
And they would, of course, want you to come out to the West Coast. And we'll find out that as the months and year go by, so that we are looking for a miracle man. I just think this is a very different kind of book, and yet it is a story, too, and has great characters. But I'm with you. A lot of times we say, I want to read the book before I see the movie, so they won't. I can tell whether or not the movie is done well, how closely they stick to the book. So I think this opens the door for many things for you, but I'm glad that others have thought that as well. Did your wife read the book? Did your daughter read the book? Or wait till it was published?
No, they not only read the book, but they read a lot of different, you know, passages as they were being written and revised. And actually, both my wife and daughter were my first editors along the way. And they were really, really helpful because, you know, when there's a lot that landed up in the waste paper basket, and rightfully so, that sometimes, you know, an author gets a little bit proprietary and a little bit precious, and, oh, I love that passage. But to a good editor, including my wife and daughter, they, you know, yeah, it's pretty nice, but guess what? You don't need it. It's bogging things down. Get rid of it. So they were really, really helpful. Ultimately, I was very lucky to have a very well-known, successful novelist named James S. Thayer actually do the real editing of the book, and he was fantastic. But yeah, my family was invaluable in getting me to a point where I was happy to then actually go to a professional editor and seek their wisdom. So yeah, they were great.
Maybe by the time your wife and your daughter had read it, and then you take it to a professional person, maybe he didn't have much in the way of suggestion or changes that needed to be made, because it sounds like you, in valuing your daughter and your wife's opinion on this, you saw they love you still, and they loved you through this. But sometimes having, being practicing law and then being an author too, and a husband and father and so on and so on, there's only 24 hours in the day, 7 days a week.
You're right, and having, shall we say, in-house editorial help is really really valuable. And it's interesting. I found with both them, of course, my wife and daughter, since they were around as it was really being developed, they actually, I would look to them for suggestions. Well, do you think this going in this direction in the plot is good, or is it not? Whatever, and they were very helpful on that too. The professional editor, the main thing he did was actually cut things out, where he'd say, "You don't need to tell us how Bobby got to that meeting. You don't need to. Just get him to the meeting." And you know, a lot of what he did was cut, because, you know, he would say, you know, you may think it's interesting to describe in great detail the interior of the CIA building, but guess what? A reader probably won't. So make a page and a half into three sentences. So he was very good at doing that, and in the end, I think he was right about a lot of that.
And so, did you have anything with these characters that you thought just had to be, if this book was accepted and published and enjoyed by many, that you could use that in the second book or part of it?
Yeah, I'll tell you one theme that I like, and I actually think it's an important theme in the book, and that is you know, the people who are against Bobby Austin. Why are they against this guy who really seems like a godsend, right? Well, one of the big foes that he has are the big pharmaceutical companies, what people call big pharma. And the reason that they consider him public enemy number one is because his view is that the trouble with the big pharmaceutical companies is that they don't cure diseases. They just invent ways of treating symptoms, and often people have to take these drugs week after week, month after month, year after year, and it's very profitable for the drug companies. While Austin, he actually wants to cure things, and that ultimately kills a lot of the cash cow drugs these big pharmaceutical companies have. So they detest him. And in the book, there's a lot of action and drama because they are opposing him in all kinds of ways. And that theme, which I think rings true if you read a lot about the shenanigans going on with the big pharmaceutical companies, that is a theme that I would definitely look to carry forward in the sequel, because it's resonated with a lot of readers, and I do think there's a lot of truth in it. And if anything, I could see that, you know, almost being heightened. And of course, it also gives its way to some good storytelling and drama and action and all that.
Of course, and I think too that, with things being what they are today, we are told over and over again that research costs so much money. That's why in the early acceptance and certification of pharmaceuticals, that they have to get some of that money back. And so we shouldn't be concerned that there are many people that even if that drug would work, they can't afford it. I mean, when you're talking thousands of dollars a month, or by the time this has, I think the real thing, you said it, that it doesn't cure many times. It just possibly gives them a little more time to take care of what they needed to take care of here. But even at that, it still seems almost a terrible thing, because those that need that particular drug, and even insurance companies won't cover it because of the prohibitive cost of it. So that's kind of a thing that tugs at all of our heartstrings, because we all know people that have been in that situation. So we would call it a miracle man.
Yeah, and that, of course, is exactly what the Miracle Man is fighting against, and why the drug companies hate him so much. But it really is true that I was reading recently about some breakthrough in cancer treatment, but they said that the cost per patient per year would be $250,000 a year, and the person would need it for many years. And of course, the insurance companies then say, well, we're not going to pay for that, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's something wrong with all of this. And if you really look at it, and Bobby Austin in the book points that out, when was the last disease actually cured? I mean, I can't remember a disease of any significance that's been cured. I don't think there's been a cure in the last 50 years. But these drug companies get bigger and bigger. I mean, they are colossally huge businesses with tremendous political influence. And as you know, in the Miracle Man book, there's a lot of interplay between the government and these big pharmaceutical companies and the CIA and all this kind of stuff, because they have tremendous clout and tremendous wealth. But isn't it crazy that in the world we live in and all the money spent on medical research, that no disease has been cured in probably 5 decades. The last disease I can remember being cured was polio. That's the last one. I mean, there's something wrong with that, and that is a theme in the book, and Bobby Austin, of course, focusing right in on that, and he's saying, this ends now, and this incredible intelligence I have, I'm going to use to change the picture here. And the drug companies go crazy because he's their worst nightmare come true.
Well, you know, you have a little bit of everything in here, and lots of people can read and enjoy and think about, but they may also be doing like the youngsters did about Harry Potter. They read this book and they can hardly wait for the next one to follow.
Well, I appreciate that. I hope that's the case. I say I've gotten some very encouraging comments from readers saying, please, please do write a sequel. So I am going to do that. But I really think, you know, within, once again, an entertainment context, because it is a novel, There are themes and ideas that I think people can latch onto and you know, think about, and that will resonate with them. You also have in the book, as you know, the political intrigue, the fact that this fictional organization I made up, government organization called the Office of Special Strategic Intelligence Services, tries to identify and corral the most profound intelligence kids in the country, and then steer them into certain knowledge and career paths. And they wanted to make Bobby Austin into an intelligence weapon, which he bridled at and rebelled against. And so then he's on the bad side of the government, certain agencies of government. So you know, that's another thing that I think has also happened, that you know, so much of the great intelligence has been wasted, because instead of it going to do these kind of things like Austin is doing, it goes into avenues just to make money, as opposed to changing the world for the better, because somehow I think in modern society that's become a secondary goal, you know?
But you have much to tell us, and I had not, I am just grateful that when I was called about would I like you as a guest, I said, please send me the book. But I envisioned all kinds of things when you said Miracle Man, right on the front. But we find out that this is a person with super intelligence, but also one that wants to use it for good. You know, in James Bond movies and things, it seemed like the one that always had the wherewithal was the evil one. But James Bond always brought them to task. But this is Miracle Man, and it's a very fitting title. Did you decide that's what your character should be, or did writing about this character lead you to believe it should be Miracle Man on the front of your book?
Well, actually, the title originated right away with the idea for the book. It just came into my mind that, okay, here's the character I'm going to create and the kind of story I want to tell, and the title just popped out to me, you know. So it was one of those things. It was there at the inception.
All right. And then you carried that out through the book and possibly the next book.
Yes. And the funny thing is, as you know from reading the book, it's probably maybe a third into the book when first you see how the title Miracle Man for Bobby Austin came about, in a subtle way, because he was never referred to that until a certain point in the book. And so I thought that was interesting and once again plausible given the context it came up in.
And you know, it is 10:23 in my studio, and I know that I'm going to let you go a few minutes ahead of time because you have another interview to go. But anything that you want to tell our listeners about how the book is available, the publisher, and all of that, and I know that it was made in the USA, San Bernardino, California, and we love to have that because we like
yes.
the USA on everything.
Exactly. I appreciate that, Judy. If people want a little bit more information on the book, they can go to the website, which is miraclemanbook.com. And on the website is an interesting video, and they can read reviews and get a synopsis and see some press. And there are also links to purchase the book. Aside from the website, they can find the book on Amazon in both paperback and Kindle, and it's also available in Nook and iBook. So it's pretty easy to find. All they have to do is just enter Miracle Man and my last name, Leibowitz, and they should have no trouble finding it. Or once again, the website, miraclemanbook.com, there are links. And the website's, I think, you know, kind of entertaining.
Of course. And so people will want to view, but also find out everything they can, because they may not have purchased the book yet. But once hearing this interview this morning, hopefully that will lead some in our area to want to read it as well. And I like to give books as gifts. And I find that many of the, even the children or the adults that I do that with, they just, I know they would be very interested in reading this book. So do you ever, on that website, miraclemanbook.com, do you ever sign any of your books that we want for special people, or just sign them so that we know the author has had their hand on this?
You know what, I would be happy to do that if anybody contacts me. I'd be very happy to do that, because I agree with you. That's one of the great things about paper copies. You can have that, and definitely happy to do that for anybody who would like to.
And they would want to follow you once you've read this book to see what else you do, and we'd want to read those too.
Well, I hope so. And, Judy, I want to thank you again for having me and being so generous with your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate those 3 years that you used writing the book and drawing us in so we can enjoy and think about a lot of things that really have real consequences and changes that could be made. William R. Leibowitz, and he allowed me to call him Bill. And, Bill, thank you so much. And I hope that if you're ever in a book signing thing around St. Louis or anything, that your publicist will let us know.
Absolutely, definitely will. Once again, thank you so much. I really appreciate being on your show.
Well, we are looking forward to seeing you everywhere in
okay.
the way of Miracle Man. Okay, thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Judy. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.